Welcome to radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to firehouse.com.
Welcome to Campus Firewatch Radio on radio at firehouse.com. My name is Ed Camo, and I'm the publisher of Campus Firewatch. Radio at firehouse.com and Campus Firewatch have joined together to bring you this podcast each month. We'll be featuring experts in the field of campus fire safety that will provide you with the most current information in their areas. Along with the interviews, there will be links on this page that will take you to information resources on the Internet that you can use every day. As we were putting together this inaugural show, the tragedy at Virginia Tech occurred. The horrific and senseless loss of life is something that will be long remembered, and our hearts go out to the families and friends of those that were killed. This also reminds us all of the importance of being prepared, both personally and as an organization, for any type of emergency, whether it's a fire, a disaster, or the tragedy that occurred at Virginia Tech. There are so many issues that come into play in a large-scale incident, such as incident command, mass notification, EMS, communications, and much more. For the May show, we're going to be doing a very special show focusing on these very issues and others. But on today's show, we're going to be covering three topics that are very relevant to campuses across the country. Starting us off is Dr. Beth DiRico, who will be discussing alcohol use on campus and its impact on the students and the community efforts that can be done to change this behavior. Unfortunately, so many of the fatal fires we have looked at over the years have had alcohol as a significant contributing factor to the deaths, and anything we can do to change this behavior will have a positive outcome. Following Dr. DiRico will be Maryland State Fire Marshal Bill Barnard. Careless disposal of smoke materials is another significant contributing factor in almost all of the fires, and Maryland was just successful in passing a Fire Safe Cigarette Act, joining about a dozen other states across the country. Marshal Barnard will be talking about exactly what a Fire Safe Cigarette is and what impact the legislation will have. Next, we'll be joined by Dr. Guylaine Prou from the National Research Council Canada. Dr. Prou is a preeminent researcher when it comes to human behavior in fires, and she's going to share with us her findings from a number of significant studies that she has done regarding how people react to fires and fire alarms. This research has been instrumental in the design of buildings and emergency procedures around the globe. With that, let's get started. Well, welcome, and today joining us on Campus Firewatch Radio, we have Dr. Beth DiRico, who's the Associate Director for the Center for College Health and Safety. Welcome, Dr. DiRico.
Thanks, Ed. Nice to speak with you again.
I was wondering if maybe you'd give us a little bit of overview over what the center does and their involvement in looking at the alcohol problem on campuses.
Sure. The Center for College Health and Safety is a national organization located at EDC in Newton, Massachusetts, the Education Development Center. We conduct applied research and provide training, consultation, technical assistance, and publications to colleges and universities so that they can create safer and healthier environments for students. We focus on mental health issues, alcohol, other drug and violence prevention, and tobacco use prevention. We've also done some work around gambling prevention. What most people know the Center for College Health and Safety for is the U.S. Department of Education's Higher Education Center for Substance Abuse and Violence Prevention is run by the Center for College Health and Safety.
And there'll be links to all that below on the webpage here, so if you look below, you can find links to both the Center for College Health and Safety and the Higher Education Center for Alcohol, Other Drug Abuse, and Violence Prevention.
Great. We also have a really nice website. In addition to chs.org, we have campushealthandsafety.org, and I don't know if you've ever had a chance to look on that site, but there's some great resources there as well.
Great. Well, like I said, we'll have those links below that everybody can go and visit and get the information directly from you. Well, what we'd like to talk about today is alcohol certainly is a problem on campuses. There's not much doubt about that. And it certainly plays a role when it comes to fire safety because in many of the fires that we've looked at, one of the contributing factors is impaired judgment because of alcohol consumption. So one of the things I'd really like to see if you can fill us in on is kind of what is the problem on campuses? I mean, what's happening? Is it going up? Is it going down? And maybe a little bit of what the, quote, average student is doing on campuses these days when it comes to alcohol consumption.
Sure. One of the best reports to give us a sense of the scope of the problem is the recent report by the National Institutes of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. The NIAAA produced a report in 2002 called A Call to Action, and this report is featured prominently on the Higher Ed Center website. What this report makes clear is that every college and university in the nation has a problem with alcohol use among students. Dangerous drinking takes a toll in the social lives of our students, in the academic lives, and in the legal scenario that students face. We see that about 1,700 students a year die from unintentional injuries related to alcohol use. Even more have unintentional injuries, sexual assaults, etc. We see that students' academic success is also affected. About 25% of students miss classes, do poorly on tests and exams, etc. What we see across the nation is that students are more and more students are abstaining from alcohol use. So there's about 20% of students across the nation that abstain. However, we see that those who drink in a dangerous way, of course, get more visibility on campus. They talk more about their experience of dangerous drinking, and that's part of what makes it seem so prominent in the social lives of students on campus today. We see more and more that there is a solid group of low-risk users, those who use in a very low and moderate way, and then there is a solid group of very, very high-risk users, those who frequently drink dangerously, in terms of the quantity and frequency of use, but also in terms of driving a car and doing other risky behaviors while they're intoxicated. We also see a phenomenon called pre-gaming or pre-funking or pre-partying, and this is where students drink prior to going to an event, and we've done some research at the center on this pre-gaming phenomenon. And here what we see is that students consume alcohol to get to a certain level of intoxication prior to going to a bar or a campus party or a campus-supported function.
It's almost like preloading, so to speak. So.
Yeah, and as administrators, we typically call it preloading. The students don't really call it that.
You mentioned dangerous drinking. I mean, you know, how do you quantify that? What do you call dangerous drinking?
That's a very good question. We have had a long conversation in our field around terminology, and we have had a lot of debate over what to call student alcohol behavior that is concerning to us. The College Alcohol Study coined the term binge drinking, and we know that there are a lot of problems with that term, and that term is now not used in our field. No journal will accept an article for publication with that term binge drinking in it. We try and have a term that resonates with students, describes a behavior accurately, and is understandable by all without being jargon. And my colleagues over at Rutgers actually coined the term dangerous drinking. And one of the things that they found, and these were some communications faculty, found that what's really nice about the term dangerous drinking is it refers to a whole scope of behaviors, including quantity, frequency, operating a motor vehicle, having unplanned sex, etc. And so it's a term that's easily understandable by students and administrators. It can mean one drink, because if you're pregnant or you're going to be driving a car, one or even two drinks is very dangerous for you. Or it could mean a lot of alcohol in your system. And so we really like that term because it captures a lot of possible scenarios. And then we can, in our conversations with students, really identify what they consider to be dangerous about drinking.
So, you know, is it possible to quantify how much the typical or average student is out there drinking? I mean, that's probably a hard thing to nail down, but...
It's different for different campuses, and at the center, we strongly, strongly encourage campuses to collect data on student alcohol use and other behaviors, because that's the only way to get a clear picture. We have national figures, such as those that I quoted from the NIAAA report, The National College Health Assessment is another good tool to get a broad snapshot of health in general, and there's about 5 questions on alcohol use. If you want to get a profile of your campus, one of the most widely used tools is the survey done by the CORE Institute.
All right, what's that again, the CORE Institute?
That's not an acronym.
Okay.
That's their name, and they're at Southern Illinois University.
Okay. So I know in dealing with a lot of administrators, some of the attitude that I seem to come across, and maybe you do too, is it's the way it is. You know, it's just the nature of the beast. It's the way colleges are. It's the way it was when I was there. It's the way it is today and the way it is tomorrow. And a lot of administrators kind of seem to throw their hands up in the air and just say it's the way it's going to be. But there have to be some effective strategies that schools have been using to try to combat this problem. Do you have some good examples of what schools have been doing?
Sure. You know, just to comment on your first point you made about the alcohol use problem being the same as it's been for the last 30 or more years, it actually isn't the same as it's been. And that's one thing that we really need to understand, that, as I said, there are a growing number of students who abstain from alcohol use. There are a percentage of students who participate in dangerous drinking. But one of the things that we're seeing is emergency room visits are rising, alcohol poisonings are rising, and more to the point, courts are holding colleges legally, criminally, civilly, monetarily liable for the behaviors of students on campus. And that's very different legal scenario than what has been the case than maybe 5 or 7 years ago.
How about students off campus? Just to digress for a minute. Are they,
sure.
Are they holding them the same level of responsibility for students doing off-campus behavior?
Some campuses are. Not every campus has campus policies that address off-campus student conduct, but many do. Going to the heart of your question around effective approaches, I have to say that when I first started in the field, there was very little knowledge about effective approaches to promoting student health and reducing danger, consequences resulting from dangerous drinking. The NIAAA report that I mentioned earlier was one of the first documents to create a compendium, if you will, of effective approaches and to really say, here are the things that are working. Here are the interventions that if you do these with college and university students, you will be successful. And so we really want to help campuses focus on those. And that is actually what I spend most of my time doing, helping campuses really focus on improving their practice around reducing dangerous consequences. And, you know, this really relies on needs assessment and understanding their campus population, and then creating a strategic plan that actually addresses the specific needs of that population. When we look at effective approaches, one of the critical things we know is that it's important to have a campus task force and to be part of a campus community coalition. While there are individual approaches, so things that we can do with individual students that work well, it's important to recognize, too, that one of the best tools we have is a good, sound campus policy that is rigorously and consistently enforced and then publicized so that students are aware that enforcement is occurring.
Can you provide a snapshot at all of you know, the students out there? Is it something that's more of a problem among freshmen versus seniors, male versus females? Is there something, or is it across the board that we're seeing here?
Well, the typical dangerous drinker is a white male. Fraternity affiliation and athletic affiliation increases the likelihood of dangerous drinking. Young women are catching up very quickly, and again, young women who are in sororities or who are athletes have a greater likelihood of drinking dangerously. We know that there is an aging out effect where students certainly drink more in their early years than in the later years. And one of the things that we do is try to provide interventions that kind of speed this aging out process up. We know that at times of transition, like the transition from high school to campus, there's a greater likelihood of dangerous drinking.
Do the students come in with a problem, or is this something that they develop in their freshman year? I would assume while they're trying to assimilate, you know, there's a new experience.
There is something about the campus environment that does encourage dangerous drinking. However, many students, you know, somewhere on the order of 80% of students, have had experience with alcohol before they come to our campuses.
Mm-hmm. How about on the other end, as they're graduating, is this behavior that is now going to stay with them for the rest of their lives, or is this something that just seems to end when they do leave the campus environment?
Well, we know that students who participate in dangerous drinking tend to keep that behavior up. Between 25 and 30, there are some changes, and certainly between 30 and 35, there are some changes. But then what happens is you're left with those who are the most dangerous drinkers continuing.
Another, kind of back to the typical student, too, are there any sort of geographic things that you see? Is it something that's more prevalent in certain regions of the country, like, let's say, the Northeast or the South or the West or anything like that?
That's a great question, Ed. Over the years, this has changed drastically. In our field, we were very conscious of the effect of regional patterns. And people would say, well, there are a lot of bars in Wisconsin, so people in Wisconsin have a heavy drinking culture. Certainly there are cultural issues. It had been up until recently that the Northeast had disproportionate higher rates of alcohol use and consequences. But if you look across the country, that is fairly leveled out now. There's only 1 or 2 percentage points of difference between campuses drinking. And indeed, the Mideast region is got highest rates of use. But across the nation, about 85% of students report drinking alcohol. And if you look then at particular regions, the lowest is in the far west, where it's 84 or so percent, and the highest is in the Mideast, where it's about 87%. 87%. The Southwest actually has, and the far west, have low rates, and they're kind of tied. But we don't see dramatic differences. There's about a 5% or 4% difference between the lowest and the highest.
So, you know, I'm an administrator out there listening to this show right now of, you know, ABC University, and I want to do something. You know, what are some of the first few steps that you would suggest for any administrator to start doing to really try to tackle this problem, and what are some of the resources, or where could they go for help on this?
Well, one of the first things to recognize is that there's federal regulations around this issue. The Drug-Free Schools and Communities Act campus regulations speak very specifically to the minimum standards that campuses must have for the prevention efforts. And one of the things that this act does is say to us that it's the sense of Congress that campuses should have a task force. So if you don't have anything going on that you're aware of, one of the first things that should happen is a task force of key stakeholders should be created. And the first step would be to inventory current policies and programs around dangerous drinking prevention. Then I would take a look at the minimum requirements in the DFSCA, the Drug-Free Schools and Communities Act, and see where we fall, whether we're in compliance or not. So the first step is to definitely be in compliance with federal regulations. The next step would be to do some data analysis and identify what the real issues are on your campus. And all of this should be done by a task force. And then create a strategic plan. The NIAAA call to action provide some wonderful articles on how to do this work, not in the summary, but in the deeper articles that were published in the Journal of Alcohol Studies. All of this can be found on the Higher Education Center's website. The most important thing is to focus not on individual students, but to focus on the environment. And what we ideally want to do is create an environment that discourages dangerous drinking. And this is a classic public health approach. And dangerous drinking is a public health problem. So we need to affect a change in the social, legal, economic environment in which students are making choices to drink dangerously.
And I know this really isn't your field, but you know, I'd like to speak a little bit to the problem that this does create from a fire safety point of view, because you know, when I talk to fire chiefs across the country, you know, they in unison they say that alcohol is the biggest problem that they have to deal with, because they're the ones that have to kind of go out there and clean up afterwards. In terms of, you know, they've had a fire that was caused by somebody who was careless because of impairment from alcohol, or you know, they're up there picking them up off the street from car accidents and things like that. So there's just so many ways that this impacts on the local fire services. And,
yeah,
you know, I would think that to address a problem, it's just not solely the responsibility of the school. It's one of those, like you just said, a community issue where the fire department, the community, and the school all have to come together and say, okay, how are we going to address this problem? Because it's something that affects us all.
Exactly. And this is very clearly the sense of Congress, the sense of the Surgeon General, et cetera. When you look at the NIAAA report, a companion document was created by the Institute of Medicine in, I think, 2003. And the Institute of Medicine report, which can also be found on the Higher Ed Center website, said that underage drinking is a problem for communities, and communities need to work with their colleges and universities around this issue, because the consequences affect everyone in the community. We know that the recent Surgeon General's report that just came out on March 6th says underage drinking is a problem for society at large in the United States, and we need to work together to address this. Indeed, Congress has just passed some legislation called the STOP Act, and it's designed to stop underage drinking. And this act, which has been authorized but not appropriated yet, requires states to report on what they're doing at the community level, at the campus level, and at the state level around underage drinking. And the report that they make must go to SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. And this must be an annual report where states do a pulse check every year on what kind of resources they're putting towards reducing underage drinking in particular.
Well, we've been speaking with Dr. Beth DiRico, who's the Associate Director of the Center for College Health and Safety. She's given us a wealth of information on the issue of alcohol use and abuse on campuses. And there certainly is a lot more information that we can fit in here in these few minutes we have with you, Dr. DiRico. But we'll have links to the websites that you've mentioned and the organizations you've mentioned right here on the page down below, so people can just take a look at those and go and download all that information. We really appreciate you taking the time to join us today here on Campus Firewatch Radio. And, you know, we look forward to hearing more about this and learning more about it, because it is a major problem in college communities across the country. So thanks for your time, Dr. DiRico.
Thanks for having me, Ed.
And joining us today on Campus Firewatch Radio is Bill Barnard, who's the Maryland State Fire Marshal. And we've asked Bill to join us because they've had a great success there in Maryland just the other day. They were able to pass the Fire Safe Cigarette Act. So we asked Bill to come here and tell us a little bit about Fire Safe Cigarettes and about what was involved in passing these things. So thanks for joining us, Bill. And, you know, what can you tell us about what you had to go through there? Because I'm sure it was not an easy process.
Well, thank you, Ed. Well, first of all, I want to, again, thank you for the opportunity to join you today. And kind of tell our story, if you want to call it that, because this has not been the easiest process, as you mentioned. This is really the culmination of 3 years' worth of work that the fire service here in Maryland has undertaken to successfully gain passage of what we call this landmark legislation. Our bill here in Maryland was known as the Cigarette Fire Safety Performance Standard and Firefighter Protection Act, because not only do we feel it's going to benefit the citizens, but our firefighters as well. I mean, less calls that they would have to go to, less time that they would be put in danger.
Well, and that's very true. I think a lot of people lose sight of that we're not only protecting the civilians' lives out there, but the lives of the firefighters that respond to these fires.
That is correct. Going back, let me roll the clock back for you. Going back 3 years ago, one of our legislators who was a firefighter as well, both a career and volunteer firefighter, Brian Moe, picked this issue up and first put in legislation. And it had a real rough start to it, quite frankly. It had a committee hearing, but it really, he saw that it wasn't even going to make it out of the committee. And we saw what we needed to do was educate folks. They really didn't know enough about the topic, enough about the issue, and enough about the impact it could potentially have on the citizens that the other delegates and senators represent. So he withdrew the bill the first year, and then we went on, embarked upon an education campaign to try to educate our legislative leaders in what is this so-called fire safe cigarette. And I'm going to divert off there for a second, because there really is no fire safe cigarette. What we're dealing with is a product and a technology that reduces the ignition propensity or ignition intensity of the cigarette, and therefore if it's left unattended or discarded, it's much less likely to set something else on fire. That's not saying it can't under the right conditions. So it's not really a quote-unquote fire-safe cigarette, even though it's been kind of dubbed that by the media.
And how does it do that? I mean, it's
does it well, there's a little out? There's a little bit different technologies out there, and patents on self-extinguishing cigarettes actually go back, believe it or not, to the mid-1800s. So the tobacco industry and folks that deal with tobacco have looked at this issue for quite some time. Unfortunately, on the federal level, this has kind of lingered around for a long time. And when you say, how does that do that? Again, there's some varying technology and some of it's patented, but one of the methods that's used is what we refer to as banded paper or speed bumps. And as you have on a cigarette, typical cigarette, you have a tobacco column, sometimes with a filter, sometimes without. That tobacco column is held in place by a wrapping of paper. And what they've done in the technology with the paper is actually make these little bands that are less porous along the tobacco column. So as the cigarette starts to burn, if it's not drawn on occasionally, then it would tend to self-extinguish. And therefore, the name self-extinguishing or fire safe. But again, it's really a reduced ignition propensity because there's so many factors, you know, airflow in the area. I mean, if you had a fan blowing on it or something like that, it may still continue to burn. Or if it was in a channeled where air would channel through, it may continue to burn. So, but from what I've seen and the demonstrations I've seen and the information I've read and the research that we've done on this, we truly feel that this is landmark legislation, because once it goes into effect, which is for us in July of 2008, then the cigarettes being sold here, we feel, are going to reduce the number of fires, reduce the number of fire injuries and fire deaths, which here in Maryland, cigarette-related fires have been the number one cause of fire deaths here for the last 10 years running, with the exception of 1 year, and accounts for about 25% of our fire deaths year in and year out.
And that's pretty much true across the nation as well. What, you know, what's happening to you in Maryland is mirrored across the country, where cigarette-related fire deaths, I mean, that's the leading cause.
That is correct. And then, of course, you know, when cigarettes are handled properly and they're well-attended in the deep ashtrays and things like that, I'm not promoting them by any stretch of the imagination. But obviously individuals that are smokers that may be intaking alcohol as well, we had a couple of early fire deaths last year that were clearly alcohol and cigarettes related, where somebody had fallen asleep, unfortunate tragic ending to those. And it not only affects the smoker, it also affects somebody else that may be in the structure. And if it happens to be an apartment building or a rooming house or something like that, you could have a whole host of other folks that are impacted by somebody else's carelessness, which is certainly another reason that we're really looking forward to this technology coming to Maryland. It's already available in three states and required in three states, New York, California, and Vermont. And there are other states that are going to be coming on board in the near future, really between now and when our legislation takes effect. And we're fortunate enough to be one of the leaders. We're the 11th state now to require this technology be sold.
I think probably one of the most telling passages was just down in Kentucky. I mean, a tobacco-generating state actually passed this legislation down there. Kind of unfortunately, it took 10 people to die in a fire to really give it some impetus, but you know, it's great to see it passing down there in a state like that. North Carolina is looking at it as well.
That's correct. In several other states, there's about 20 states now that are looking at this. Again, I call it life-saving or landmark legislation. When we had our first hearing this year, for example, there were only six states that had actually passed the legislation. Since we had our first hearing in our Senate back in mid-February, there were four other states, including Kentucky, Utah, New Jersey, and Oregon, that passed nearly identical legislation to what we passed in a final vote, which took place just last Wednesday. And we, the entire Maryland Fire Service, is looking forward to a bill signing with the governor. We had great support in the legislature this year. Again, this was the culmination of a three-year process. We came so close last year, Ed. It was unbelievable. The last day of the session, the waning hours of our General Assembly session, the bill was set off to the side on what's known as a special order so somebody could take another look at it, and it just ran out of time. We passed the House. We got out of the Senate committee. The votes weren't anywhere close to what they were this year. This year, we only had one individual in the entire General Assembly vote against the bill, and I got to say, we had great support from the governor. Governor O'Malley was behind this right from the start.
I'm kind of curious, what's some of the opposition that you do get to it? What's the rationale people are using for opposing legislation? Because to those of us involved in fire safety, it just seems like mom and apple pie. But there is some serious opposition out there. I'm kind of curious what they're saying as to why you shouldn't have this kind of technology.
Well, it does to a degree, and some of it, the tobacco industry is somewhat changing. They were vehemently opposed actually the last 2 years and really fought us on this. I mean, we worked with them somewhat in the interim between sessions, and we had we had at least one of the tobacco companies, Altria, came out and actually supported the legislation. And RJR, which came in the initial hearing against the legislation, we made some slight modifications to our bill that certainly, and we feel, no way lessened the impact of it. But they withdrew their opposition as well, kind of partway through the process. And a part of that is that little bit of give and take that you do have. And again, I think we're going to achieve the ultimate goal that we were seeking here. Again, it's been a big problem in Maryland, as it is across the country. And we're taking these little baby steps. It's unfortunate in my mind that the federal government, who has had several attempts at this, if you want to call it that, going back to the mid-80s when they passed some fire-safe cigarette legislation requiring our friends at NIST, the National Institute for Standards and Technology, which is right here in Gaithersburg, Maryland, to work on a standard for this, and they came up with that eventually. New York, to their credit, picked this thing up. It took them a process. It took nearly 4 years to develop their regulations using the standard and working with the folks at NIST and all the public comments, and they were finally, they're kind of like the leader in this, and they're looked to as the de facto standard. So our legislation is really modeled after their bill and their regulations, and we've got it all laid out. There are concerns a little bit over commerce as well. You know, is there going to be a level playing field for the those that are in the tobacco industry? Does somebody hold a competitive advantage for one reason or another? So all those concerns needed to be addressed. We did that through education, meeting with our senators and delegates, and quite frankly, energizing the fire service to come together and really focus on this. We had the chiefs across the state, both career and volunteer. We had the union backing this. We had the Volunteer Fire Service, the Maryland State Firemen's Association, and really brought a lot of focus, and the legislators heard from their constituents. We had constituents across the board from various groups, senior citizens and others, got involved in this process, and it was very successful in the end.
And looking at the campus fire safety arena, it is certainly one of the significant problems we've identified. And as a matter of fact, you hit on two of them right there. And the common scenario is somebody's been drinking and they've been smoking and careless disposal of the cigarette, and, you know, rolls down into a couch or into a seat cushion and just lies there during the night.
Right, or dumped into a trash can where it sits there and will continue to smolder for a period of time. And then when everybody goes to sleep, then that's when the real problems exist, not only for those folks that are directly impacted, but for the firefighters that have to come out as well.
Yeah, no, I think this is a tremendous step forward, and I really give you a lot of credit for really, you know, sitting on it and pushing it and making it happen down there, because it does take a lot of effort, doesn't it? You just have to keep bird-dogging it, don't you?
There's no question about it. This is my sixth General Assembly as the fire marshal. One year I had five departmental bills down there going back a couple years. I've spent more time in Annapolis this year working with the legislature, various members of the legislature, meetings with the members of the committee, meeting with committee staff, providing them answers to questions. And we did have a number of questions that came up at the hearings, which we did all the research. We called whoever we needed to in to assist us, including the current acting state fire marshal up in New York, John Mueller, who I look at, quite frankly, as the godfather of this, since he worked on it for so many years up there in New York. And all those folks were of great assistance to us. Again, it was a team effort here, and everybody in the fire service, as well as a host of others, really got behind this effort, and it really showed in the end. Other states are having similar success, I might add, and I think, as you indicated earlier, we're going to reach a point here where the manufacturers will probably go ahead and turn their entire process and technology and produce this one type of cigarette across the country. It's already being done across the entire country of Canada, and there's already one smaller manufacturer that has indicated in late February that that's what their plans are.
Great.
So we're looking forward to that. We're happy to be a part of it and actually feel like we're a part of the leadership here.
Well, congratulations to you and everybody else down there in Maryland that worked so hard on pushing this through, because it is a great step forward for, you know, for, as we said, the civilians out there and the fire service and the firefighters who have to respond to these fires. You know, anything we can do to stop that from happening is just a big, massive leap forward. So, well, we've been talking to the Maryland State Fire Marshal, Bill Barnard. We appreciate your coming and joining us and telling us about the passage of the Fire Safe Cigarette Act down there in Maryland. And, you know, as I said, congratulations on just a big step forward for everybody down there.
Thank you very much, Ed, and I appreciate the opportunity to join you today.
Well, you've been listening to Campus Firewatch Radio on radio@firehouse.com. My name is Ed Camo, and we'll be back right after the break.
Radio@firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Okay, joining us today on Campus Firewatch Radio is Dr. Guilain Proulx with the National Research Council of Canada. Welcome,
hello.
Dr. Proulx.
Hello, how are you?
Good, glad you could join us. Dr. Proulx is one of the recognized authorities on when it comes to human behavior in fires. As a matter of fact, as I was doing research for this podcast and for other articles, everybody kept referring back to Dr. Proulx's work. So she is definitely the authoritative voice on this whole issue, which she will deny, but she is definitely, I've worked with her for a number of years now. And it's probably one of the most knowledgeable people I know when it comes to this whole area.
Well, I certainly do a lot of work, but I'm not sure I'm the leading figure, as you said, but thank you anyway.
Well, I think we'll probably start a little bit. A lot of people don't really know a lot about human behavior when it comes to fire. It's a new field to them. It's something they may not have heard about. So maybe you could take a few minutes and just kind of explain the work that you do.
Well, the work that I do is essentially trying to understand how people behave and respond when they are faced with a fire. There are different means by which this kind of research can be conducted. For example, we can study fire drills. So that's part of the work that I do. We put up video cameras in buildings, and we trigger the fire alarm, and we film and study what people do. Sometimes we introduce some kind of different elements. We may block one exit door. We may have specific messages issued to give instruction to occupants. So that's one of the ways to study human behavior. Another way is to look to talk with victims or survivors following major incidents, such as what happened at the World Trade Center, for example, or the Rhode Island, the station fire in the club there. Talking with survivors allows us to get a very good account of what were the elements in place when people had to face that event.
And you've been doing this for a number of years, and I know you've done a number of significant fires, some of which I've worked on with you.
Mm-hmm.
What do you find out of these? Some of the apartment fires you've done up there in Canada, I think, would be very relevant to the kind of occupancies that many students are living in when it comes to off-campus. So maybe you could discuss some of the findings on some of the apartment building fires you've taken a look at.
Yes, certainly. And you're right that residential buildings and dormitories or residences where students live might be very similar. Among the findings that we have is that we found that in the initial moment of an emergency, people are very often taken aback by the ambiguity of the information that they perceive and may not do very much when, for example, hearing the fire alarm. They are used to false alarm and they expect that this is simply another false alarm, and oftentimes they don't do very much in the initial moment. They may even smell some smoke or see some smoke, but usually they will attribute that to something really not important or not dangerous. And they might take some time in, just waiting to get more information. Eventually, they might call the superintendent or some person who is responsible in the building, trying to get some more information on what is going on. But the initial moment are characterized by people being very slow in responding, which is, a behavior that we are really trying to change, because time is the most important factor during a fire. People have very limited time to escape safely, so they need to start immediately when they get the initial cues that there is actually an emergency in the building. So people should take any alarm very seriously, investigate it to make sure that what is going on doesn't require behavior from them, and take any of these cues very seriously, because a fire can happen anytime, anywhere.
And even after they make the decision to evacuate, you have that delay built in that you were just talking about. Isn't even more time built in that I've made the decision to evacuate. It's not always the case where they just get up and go right out the door, is it?
That's true. Even once they have made the decision that they should evacuate, they usually take time at getting dressed, getting some belongings, sometimes going to next door neighbor if it's a friend or somebody they know to warn them of what's happening. And all these kind of behavior takes take some time and unfortunately extend or reduce actually the overall time they will have to escape. So this initial moment is very important, and we need to try to reduce it as much as possible. And we have found in residential building that sometimes the what we call the pre-movement time, so this time of figuring out what's happening and getting ready, can be around 2-3 minutes. And unfortunately, this is too long because an actual fire can become totally, well, completely lethal in less than that. So actually people have much less than that. 30 seconds would be probably more realistic. So that means people really have to hurry up when they perceive the initial cues.
Now, many of the people we're talking about, students, also go to, you know, bars, nightclubs, movie theaters, that sort of thing. And you mentioned the Station nightclub fire, which was the horrific fire that killed 100 people down there in Rhode Island. Do you find similar behavior when somebody is, you know, they're in a bar, they're in a nightclub, and there's an unsafe condition, you know, there's smoke developing or the alarm goes off? Do you find a similar kind of reaction among the public in those occupancies as well?
Indeed, research that has been conducted in public or entertainment type of venues have demonstrated that initially, in the initial moment, again, occupants have a tendency to think that the smoke or even an alarm bell is a false alarm, is not the real thing, or is part of the show, as it was probably the case in the Rhode Island fire when the sparkle of fireworks started. People didn't notice readily that actually the situation was getting was not right, that something bad was happening. And suddenly being in an environment with a lot of other people surrounding you that do just like you, so do nothing, it's not an incentive to be the first to start. And that's something that needs to be changed. People should not be worried or concerned to be the first to react, even to overreact to something that is not a dangerous situation. After all, we can always come back to the building if at the end of the day there is no danger. But the initial moment is crucial, and people need to start their movement right away. Otherwise, they will be crushed or tied up in a lot of occupants that wants to escape all at the same time. So the ones that start the earliest are the most likely to make it safely outside. This is why it's so important to react right away. And suddenly the effect of alcohol, loud music, dim lighting doesn't help a person to figure out what is happening around them. But suddenly when going into these kind of buildings, students or, well, anybody should be aware of where are the different exits, not just the entrance by which they have come into the building, but the other emergency exits. So if ever the situation calls for egress, they will have some alternative and won't go with, well, probably the majority of the crowd will go to the main entrance exit, and if they have noticed alternative exits, they will have some other means to escape safely.
Now, you mentioned that there's a hesitation on people to kind of stand out, to be the first one to do something. If there is one person that starts moving, does the rest of the crowd tend to follow that lead? I mean, if somebody does become the leader, so to speak, does the rest of the crowd go along with them once the ice has been broken, so to speak?
Actually, yes. Usually, you just need a few people that notice that something is wrong and decide to move away, and all the others will start suddenly to realize, and also for themselves, they will look around and realize that something is wrong. So you need only a couple of people that get started for the rest of the crowd to be more aware of their surrounding and suddenly realize that evacuation or leaving the space is necessary. So I wish that all the students that we are talking to today would be this leader, would be this person who is the first to see that something is wrong and really show the others that, yes, it's better to get out before the situation gets too bad.
And in a dormitory, for example, a typical person there could be would be somebody like the resident assistant, who's the student in charge of that floor, could certainly play that leadership role in getting the ball rolling, so to speak, getting everybody out the door.
But yes, you're right. That student has been identified to play that role, and we hope that this person is there at the time that a situation takes place. But we should not necessarily completely rely on others to warn us that there is actually an emergency. Each and every single person should take responsibility for themselves and ensuring that they do something when they perceive something out of the ordinary.
And one of the things I'd like to ask you to touch upon, too, is that you've talked to me quite a bit about is the myth of panic. That, you know, you see it so often in the media that people panic in these situations. Maybe you could explain that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. Panic is a word that suddenly, as you said, the media really like, because it makes newspapers sail. It's very good in the movies as well to see a screaming crowd rushing to an exit or something like that. However, the reality of fire is somewhat slightly different. We know that going through a fire situation is certainly a stressful event, because most people are not very accustomed, or they don't know very much about fire. But the response that we observe the most during fires is not a response of panic. On the contrary, people tend to be very reasonable. They are thinking for themselves, trying to understand the situation, and trying to make the best decision for the situation that is unfolding in front of them. Oftentimes, they don't have all the elements to really understand what's going on, but most times, the response that they have is the response to trying to adapt to what is going on. And usually, the response is correct, and very rarely people will do something totally irrational, jumping from a window, for example, unless really it's really the last resort that they are faced with. So most people are very rational, trying to make the best decision. And another behavior that we observe a lot is a behavior of being helpful, of trying to help people around one another and to live together when there is an emergency. People suddenly become very good human beings, prepared to help even complete stranger to escape safely from a building.
Now, you talked about earlier that, you know, people take a long time to actually recognize as a condition and then react to it appropriately, again, building in that delay where the fire continues to grow. What role does training and education play in closing that window? I mean, I would have to assume that a person that has been through some level of training is probably going to react sooner and better than an untrained person. I mean, that just kind of seems like a common sense sort of situation.
You are absolutely right, Ed. A person that has been has gone through training actually will be better prepared to recognize the initial signs of an emergency and will know how to respond. One of the things that happens here is when you do training, you learn about a building, you learn to recognize the sound of the alarm, you learn to know how the building is designed, where are the exits. And all this is in your memory, your long-term memory. And if ever you need this information during an event, a sudden event, an unexpected event, all this information will come back to you and help you make the decision. Even if you are under stress, because you've been through training, it will be a lot easier to make the right decision when comes the time. This is why training is crucial. I know that some people take evacuation drill as, okay, well, you know, we're not in elementary school anymore. Why should we go through all that? Well, it's very useful. It's useful for each individual to get some background knowledge about what they are expected to do in case of an emergency. And it's also very important for the management of, for example, the university, to ensure that the the procedure that they have in place is going to work if there is an emergency. During drills, oftentimes we notice that little things are not working exactly as expected. You may have, for example, a sounder of an alarm that didn't ring in a location. Well, by doing a drill, you get to know what you need to improve and where the system may have failed to fix that and ensure that everything is working perfectly well if ever a condition develops. So training, yes, it's absolutely essential.
And you brought up a great point there, too, that a fire drill isn't necessarily just for training the people, but a good chance to evaluate your procedures, evaluate the how the building, you know, how they can get out of the building. So it's good for the administration as a learning experience as well.
That's right.
Yeah. I think Dr. Fahey from the NFPA has a great statement. I might be misquoting it, but one of the things that comes out of the human behavior studies is we want to design buildings not how we, what is it, not how we want people to do react, but how they really react, in other words.
Yeah.
The building has to be designed how people really are going to react to a situation.
Yeah, that's right. For several years in the past, let's say maybe 25 years ago, for the longest time, we thought that we could put procedures in place and assume that people was going to follow these procedures. We have discovered through time that, people are intelligent and are going to make decisions according to what's going on around them. And if you ask them to do something that doesn't seem to make sense, they are not going to do it. So what that means that we have to understand what people are really understanding, really likely to do, and adapt ourselves, the procedure, to what kind of behavior and response people are likely to have. And we are working in that sense for the last few years, and I think it's providing a lot of positive feedback that more and more people understand procedures in building, they understand what is expected from them, and they are prepared to play their part and to actually participate. And we have every day around the country evacuation that are taking place during real events, and they work out very well. And if people are well trained, the building is well organized, has a good procedure in place, good systems, the evacuation will run very smoothly and everybody will come out safely.
Well, we've been talking with Dr. Prue from the National Research Council of Canada on human behavior in fires. Dr. Prue has written a number of excellent studies, and if you look down on the page here, you'll find some links that we'll put there to these studies. They're really very eye-opening when it comes to how people react in the very occupancies that we're talking about, where many students live, you know, dormitories, apartment buildings, and such. And I think it's great for any administrator or campus fire official to take a look at to learn from these and, you know, design their buildings and their procedures so that they'll be in accordance with how people will really react, not necessarily how you want them to react. So, Dr. Prue, we really appreciate you joining us from Canada today on Campus Fire Watch Radio, and we appreciate all the work that you do.
Well, it was a real pleasure, and I wish everybody to stay safe from fire.
Well, you've been listening to Campus Fire Watch Radio on radio@firehouse.com. Be sure to join us next month for a very special show that will look at emergency preparedness on campus and what you can do at your school or in your community. My name is Ed Camo, and thanks for joining us.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.